Hello and welcome to another Linguistics Career Cast, the podcast devoted to exploring careers for linguists outside academia. I'm your host, Laurel Sutton. Mary Caitlin Valentinson earned her PhD in anthropology and linguistics in a joint program from University of Arizona in 2019. Her dissertation research was on fandoms, the way communities engage with pop culture. After finishing her degree, she taught at Appalachian State University for 3 years. In August 2022, she took a position with Universal Parks and Resorts in Orlando, Florida, where she works as a manager of ethnographic research. Topics discussed include anthropology, networking, transferable skills, ethnography, qualitative research, focus groups, sociolinguistics, discourse analysis, and fandom. The link to Mary Caitlin's LinkedIn profile is in the show notes. Well, we have a treat today. I am so delighted to welcome Mary Caitlin to the podcast. Thank you for joining us today.
I'm so excited to be here.
Yeah. You know all the same people that I do. I was looking at your LinkedIn profile and we have like 20 plus people in common, which is great. I love it. Yeah. I love our community. I love that we all know each other. And you have a lot of crossover with anthropology, which I really want to dig into because that's been much on my mind lately. And you have a really cool job as well. So let's start at the beginning. And can you tell me about how you found out about linguistics?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I love telling this story. I was one of those really nerdy high schoolers who, through one way or the other, I had heard the word linguistics, and I kind of vaguely understood that was something I wanted to pursue. I was the kid who was, you know, overly interested in grammar in my high school English classes and really cared about sort of definitely a lot of it motivated by some prescriptivist tendencies, which I quickly unlearned in my first semester of intro to linguistics. But I had this laser focus on this this just broad interest in language from a really early age. And so first thing I did when I got to university was find the intro to linguistics class and sign up for it, even though I had to, it was sort of outside the normal core requirements. And I remember I had to do some arguing and fussing to be allowed to take that. And I had the fabulous luck of having an amazing professor for that first class. And I remember vividly, she walked into class first day, it's my first semester freshman year, and she had this great big bombastic attitude. And she said, let's do this, like, let's learn linguistics. And I thought, I got to be this lady when I grow up. That's exactly who I want to be. And we just spent the rest of the semester, you know, it was a pretty intro class. And in fact, the university I attended for undergrad didn't have a standalone linguistics department or major. So the kind of relationship I've had with anthropology came in quite early because this intro to linguistics class was through the anthropology department. And, you know, it's just a fabulous class. It was in our sort of sociolinguistics unit that I also have a quite vivid memory of waiting for a room to open. We were about to go in with the instructor for, shout out to Dr. Miriam Bach, who taught that class, for our final exam review. And she sort of said, in like a very, you know, positive kind of offhand way, like, she said, way to be a curve buster on that sociolinguistics exam, because I had done really well on it. And that was the moment where I thought, ooh, maybe that's, you know, that positive reinforcement. Maybe that's the area I should start exploring. And of course, given that all these linguistics classes were within the context of an anthro department, that's what a lot of those classes were, kind of focused on overlap between language and social issues and cultural kind of factors. And so I just took as many of those classes as I could. And I ended up doing one of those little, one of those programs where you sort of design your own major, where the major was functionally take every linguistics related class you can across the entire university system. But it was fantastic. And so it was really that, you know, that early interest coupled with that moment at the very beginning of my sort of academic career where I saw someone really inspiring and cool doing the kind of work that I thought was inspiring and cool. And that's what put me on that path.
Wow, that's great. My experience was sort of similar. In my undergrad, there was no linguistics department at Rutgers at the time. So I too took many classes from many departments. And one of the ones that really solidified my interest was a linguistic anthropology class, which,
Oh, there you go. Yeah,
it was so cool to have those two things intersect. And I hadn't taken any anthro classes before that, but we focused a lot on social changes of language in Europe, but also on folklore, which was really cool.
Ooh,
and that
cool.
has, yeah. And then like linguistics and folklore is so cool. Yeah. You don't get that anywhere else. So that was great. So when you finished your undergrad, what were your thoughts like? Were you dead set on going to graduate school? Did you take some time off to work? What happened?
I was laser focused. Even, you know, and the laser goes way back to high school, but yeah, I was, I really wanted the kind of career that that first inspirational professor had. And I had been involved in, you know, kind of serving in some sort of undergrad research assistant roles. I had done some of my own research and had been lucky enough to present some of that as at some poster sessions, even as an undergrad. And I was really excited about the community that the folks I was meeting in these academic linguistic spaces. So I do think in retrospect, just when I'm reflecting on that jump, I often advise people to consider, you know, taking a gap year or two to just just get different kinds of experiences. Not that I certainly wouldn't say I have regrets about the path I took, because I had a fabulous experience in grad school too, but it's, you know, there's so many other ways to use these skills and these kind of the training and the background and the theoretical frameworks we learn in linguistics and in anthropology. And I was just not, I don't know, I don't think I really gave those things a fair shot until much later on in my career. Mm-hmm. But so, yeah, I jumped straight into grad school. I went to the University of Arizona because they have a joint anthropology and linguistics
yes.
PhD program. Which sounds really fancy. It kind of is fancy. It's sort of like a double major PhD, right? Much like you might do for an undergrad double major. But the ability to get that like super in-depth theoretical training in linguistics, and also, you know, the School of Anthropology at the U of A is very highly regarded and has these great linguistic anthropologists. I just thought, great, I get something from all these different parts of the world, these different disciplines that are connected but distinct. I get a little bit of both, so that's fantastic. And it was, I will say, yeah, quite driven by my desire. I really saw myself being an academic and being a professor. And so that's what I was working on for most of that time.
Shout out to Natasha Warner, my cohort.
Shout out to Natasha
yeah.
Warner.
We were at Berkeley at the same time. She was 1 year after me. She's amazing. So cool. And we've had the LCL has had conversations with University of Arizona because they are one of the small but very significant number of universities that really encourage their students to get careers outside academia. Like they track them and they celebrate them and they have alum come back and talk about what they do. And they're really into integrating the local communities because, of course, they do a lot of work with the indigenous folks who live in Arizona as well. So they have so many things going for them, and their model for the career paths for their students, I think, is really good one and should be adopted by more linguistics departments across the country. That would be great.
Oh, yeah. I couldn't agree more. I think I will say that while I was there, you know, I had my personal focus on getting an academic job and staying in academia. But, you know, there's, you hear externally these almost horror stories of people talking about advisors or professors who are really unsupportive or really dismissive
yeah.
of anybody who even expresses curiosity about those careers. And
yep.
That was never the vibe at the U of A. There was, I think the challenge is always faculty, because they don't often have those other kinds of career experiences themselves. They don't
yes.
always know the best place to point students, but, the excitement and the willingness to support in whatever ways possible Arizona students who were exploring other career paths, that was always there. And and we should also shout out the, I don't want to get the name wrong, the Human Language Technology Master's Program. I think that's the correct name at the University of Arizona. But that's, I remember that model, that program launched while I was a graduate student there. And that master's program has always been you know, it's always had space for both people with more sort of professional or corporate orientations mm-hmm. and people that maybe saw themselves taking another step into a PhD afterwards. There is an internship structure built in. That's quite explicit in that program. And so mm-hmm. even though that wasn't my area, I was always surrounded by people who had explored or dipped their toes into or were actively pursuing other types of careers. Mm-hmm. And I'm sure that just sort of contributed to this broader kind of open-minded environment to mm-hmm. Lots of different career paths for linguists.
Yeah, you bring up a really important point there, which I think is sometimes overlooked, which is that many universities and especially linguistics departments, because like you said, the professors just don't have any experience with jobs outside of academia, so they don't really know how to do it. And that's fine as long as they are supportive in the way that they talk to people about what they could do with their degrees.
Absolutely.
And that's anybody can do that, right? And it's very different from, as you said, the active discouraging of people for having careers outside of academia, which still happens in lots of departments across the country. So
yeah, sad to say, but it does.
Bare minimum, just don't discourage people. Like you don't yeah. have a whole program set up to support them, but just like, you know, be fair.
Of course.
So You're going through this program and you're laser focused on it, and then you graduated. What happened after that?
Well, after I graduated, I had a non-tenure track position at Appalachian State University in North mm-hmm. Carolina. It was in their anthropology department. That's awesome. Given mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I was pretty realistic about the state of the job market when I graduated, and so I was thrilled to have anything, right? But it was, it was actually the wonderful department with great people who were really, really supportive of me and really supportive of, the sort of outsized teaching labor, especially that non-tenure track folks end up doing. I was sort of just expecting things to work out in a particular way. And I guess mm-hmm. that's, I don't know. I have to reflect on that one more. But I was happy working in that department. Loved the students, loved my colleagues. Had my contract renewed a few times, so I felt pretty accepted there. But it's not the same thing, of course, of having that sense of security, even though yeah. we know it's not not quite as secure as it might have been in the past. That sense of security of a tenure track position, where I think people feel like they expect that once they get that, they'll feel like they made it. I think we also know the feeling like you're on the hamster wheel continues once you get to mm-hmm. that point.
Yeah.
I was just staying on the job market, applying to jobs anywhere and everywhere and casting a wide net and hoping something would stick. During that time, and even occasionally during my my graduate school experience, I would every once in a while see an interesting looking non-academic job. And without much forethought or planning, would maybe just throw my hat in the ring, throw out an application, see what happens, which is my strategy for a lot of things. I'll just try mm-hmm. something and mm-hmm. see what happens.
Sure.
And I hadn't really had any responses to those, which I wasn't surprised or sad about, because to be fair, I also, I had a resume that condensed my academic experience into something that I hope sounded vaguely more, professionally or corporate oriented, but not with a lot of forethought or strategy behind it. Just here's something shorter. Let's see what happens, and not thinking too hard about it, because what I really wanted was an academic job. Mm-hmm. That started to shift when my partner and I had been doing the long distance thing since, day one of grad school. And we were still doing the long distance thing while I was in North Carolina. And it was just getting to a point, this is a very human thing, but it's just we're good at it. But it was starting to weigh on us. And yeah. so I just sort of started to mentally shift my plan that, if the tenure track job that I was hoping for didn't come through in the next job cycle, then I would let my contract with the university I was at kind of expire, and I'd move back to New York, and the plan stops there. I had some sort of vague sense that I might take some kind of boot camp or all these sorts of quick professionalization avenues just to sort of reframe your work and repackage yourself for a different mm-hmm. type of job market. But it was, yeah, there was no real thought behind that. I just thought that's a problem for future me. I'll deal with that when I get there. Mm-hmm. And then a friend of a friend passed me a job ad that she saw on LinkedIn mm-hmm. for this very interesting job title, Manager of Ethnographic Research at Universal Orlando Theme Park. And I thought, same thing I had thought for all the other non-academic jobs I applied for, like, might as well throw my hat in the ring, because what a crazy job title.
Yeah.
I'm looking at the skills. I'm looking at what they're asking for. I know how to do all this stuff. Feeling really certain that I'd never hear from them, because I don't have, I was presuming they wanted some kind of corporate background. Mm-hmm. Knowing what I know now, it's silly that I assumed that a job title that's Manager of Ethnographic Research wasn't written by somebody with a background in academic anthropology. Mm-hmm. In fact, as I found out pretty quickly in the interview process, many people, I mean, we've got PhDs from linguistics, from political science, from organizational psychology, and my direct supervisor is an anthropology PhD. She's a medical anthropologist. So,
oh, wow, cool.
Yeah, no way I could have known that ahead of time, really. I mean, I probably could have done more LinkedIn stalking. I did not, because I just thought this is a hoot that isn't going to go anywhere. But, you know, in retrospect, it really clarified what my application probably looked like on her end. No, I don't have the corporate work world experience, but she can look at my publications, or, you know, nobody's reading my dissertation, but she can skim it and say, yeah, actually, I have the background and the tools to assess whether or not this person is a fit for the work that we want to mm-hmm. do here, which is building an ethnographically focused qualitative research team. And so, yeah, that was a really funny experience when I got on that first interview with her. And she said, well, I'm not going to ask you the typical interview questions, because what I really want to know is, are you going to be happy leaving academia? This would be a big leap for you. And yeah, wow, that was a real wake up call almost, because I hadn't thought about that, because at this point it was just a hypothetical, wouldn't this be silly possibility. And it ended up being a great conversation. And just, I mean, her, the fact that she was willing to talk to me about that right away, also to me, that was kind of a green flag. It made me feel, wow, she kind of like cares about me as a person and wants me to be happy mm-hmm. if I take this job. Mm-hmm. And so I better assess whether I would actually be happy taking a job like this.
Yes, yes.
Anyway, now I'm telling a lot of the story, but that's kind of how I got to this place, which was not with any targeted or directed strategy, but a pretty broad open-mindedness to throw my hat in the ring for anything that I thought looked kind of interesting. And then when one such interesting opportunity kind of materialized into something more serious, that was a moment where I really paused to say, oh, wow, like, I think I have an opportunity to kind of change trajectory here. And let me pause and think about whether I want to do that.
Yeah. Oh, so many. That's such a great story. So I have many questions. Just backing up a little bit, when you were sending out your resume to non-academic jobs, did you get any interviews from those jobs, or was it just sending out your resume?
No, I was just sending out my resume. And again, it was not, I mean, I, knowing what I know now about the sort of corporate world and how those hiring processes go, I can think of a million things that were probably not necessarily red flags, but just, I'm not going to bother talking to this person. And I don't blame them, because they probably got a ton of applications.
Yeah.
And so it was sort of a mix of, you know, again, this orientation I have to many problems, which is let me just throw something out there and see what happens and mm-hmm. react accordingly. Mixed with the fact that there is a different strategy for these sorts of roles. It's not usually somebody with a PhD in your discipline assessing your application, right? It's usually someone with no understanding of what linguistics is at all.
Right. They're in HR. They don't know what it means.
Precisely. Yeah. And so, I would take a different approach now, I think. I just of course I had all this training in how to apply for academic jobs. I had no overt training in how to apply for other kinds of positions, except make your CV shorter. 1 to 2 yes. page resume. I mean, that's about all I knew. So that's what I did. And you know, and it was a toss up most of the time.
Yeah. So your experience really speaks to a couple of things that in this podcast and through the Linguistics Career Lounge, we've emphasized a lot, which is the importance of having a tailored resume for the jobs that you're applying for, right? Like if you had to do it all over again, you probably would have spent the time trying to insert keywords and tailor your resume to the actual job that you were applying for, like each and every job, right? That's one thing. And the other thing is the importance of networking, right? Like that's how you got your job. It was because you knew somebody. And it helps. Like you can do all those things with your resume, but the networking part of it just is so important. It doesn't mean you're going to get a job that you apply for, but the stronger and broader your network is, the more likely it is that there will be somebody at the place you're applying for who could put in a good word for you or give you some information or whatever.
Or that you even learn about the jobs that are interesting to you in the first place, right? I mean, I wouldn't have seen this job. And I mean, it's funny because all my little LinkedIn, you know, interests are aligned with this job, but I just didn't have the quite right overlap without this friend of a friend connection who could say, hey, like, I know vaguely enough about your work to think that you might be interested in something like this. That would not have crossed my feet at all if it wasn't for if it wasn't for my social network.
Yep, exactly. So all of these things, incredibly important. It's on my mind because I just got back from talking to some students who are linguistics grad students just about careers in general. And they are all, they want to learn about this, but no one's talked to them about it before. And all the advice I was giving about LinkedIn, they're like, do I really have to do all that? It's like, yeah, you really, you do. You actually do. You have to put up a nice picture of yourself. You have to have a nice email address that's not a Hotmail address, right?
Yeah.
And you have to fill it out in a way that looks professional because that's your public face. So you need to make it as professional and complete as possible in a way that's understandable to folks in the corporate world. So that's the other thing that I hear in your story is this stuff about transferable skills, right? They're not going to read your dissertation, but you have to be able to present your relevant and transferable skills to an employer. Like, this is what I can do for you. My skills are what you need to fill this position.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think there's, I mean, I think there's also this kind of uncertainty about where the topical or thematic expertise comes in. And I think for, you know, for a lot of linguists, there's a ton of interest in conversation design and AI. I mean, there's a lot of places where linguistics topical background can fit in really well. But there's a lot of really interesting jobs out there for somebody that has the skills of a linguist, but is not necessarily related to, you know, your research expertise on, I don't know, some kind of really interesting morphological phenomenon in Maltese or these sorts of things. And I think that also requires kind of a just sort of an open mind about what you can do, what those skills are in the abstract level and what sort of places might be fun to apply them.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, it's all about your skills and what you can do with them and how that's going to serve the place that you want to get a job at. It's probably not going to be what you did your dissertation on or one of your theses, but it's the skills doing taxonomies or data analysis or, you know, whatever. That's why it's a transferable skill because you're transferring it from one area to another. So cool. So like, what the heck is your job? What do you do?
It's a great question. So the role of manager of ethnographic research, I mean, one reason it's been really fun to take on this job is because I'm the first one to have it at this organization. It's my senior director was for a variety of reasons, kind of got buy-in to build out a stronger qualitative research program. We have great quantitative survey researchers here, like really some of the best in the business. Not that I'm biased, but I think they're great. You know, she created this atmosphere in the company where there was more hunger and interest for qual research. And that's what I'm trained to do as a sociolinguist and linguistic anthropologist. So nobody knew what a manager of ethnographic research was going to do besides continue to support that work, do more qual work, build the qual program at Universal, and find ways to show how valuable that type of information and that type of research can be to our organization. So a lot of the first year on the job here was defining what that role was going to be. I mean, I, there's the abstract stuff that we expected it to include, which is doing sort of research projects that highlight typically struggles or issues that guests are having in the theme park, and kind of documenting it from a holistic perspective to understand, well, what's happening here, and what are different people, the perceptions of this issue from different points of view, both internally and externally, and kind of showing how that fits together as a broader story, as a broader narrative, to take to the leadership to say, you know, here's the information about what's going on, and sometimes offer suggestions about how to act on that. But another thing that's happened as we've kind of defined this role and started to build the team more is that it's also become, and this happens a lot in especially ethnographically oriented field work, is you kind of also become a point person for connections across the organization, right? Mm-hmm. I think especially in really big organizations, there are roles and teams and work that can get really siloed because it's massive. I mean, we have something like 30,000 people just here in Orlando, right? And it's besides that, it's like a big international company. So one thing that happens is as you conduct the kind of research I do, where I'm talking to stakeholders all across the organization, different teams, documenting different points of view, is I start to have a more kind of complex and nuanced bird's eye view of who everyone is and how everyone else's work touches each other. So, you know, aside from the research that we do, which is, it's qualitative work that's largely oriented around this term we sort of call consumer insight. So just learning about who our guests or our customers are and what their beliefs are and preferences and what kind of stuff they want out of a theme park and what's going well and not going well. Another big thing a lot of the researchers, not just me, in this organization end up doing is noticing those connections between people and groups and kind of facilitating better and more in-depth conversations between them. Sometimes using our research as kind of the focal point, right? You both have work or projects that touch this guest issue. And so I'm going to share with both of you at the same time what we found out about it from a research perspective. And then since we're all talking about the same thing and we're sharing the same set of facts, we can actually have a conversation outside of those silos. So it's a little bit of research and a little bit of kind of connecting people and sort of drawing the lines between different dots and a lot of doing work that helps the organization better understand who are the guests that come to our theme park, what they want, what they need, ways that we can, help them have a really awesome time on their vacation or their visit.
So to get into the nitty gritty a little bit, do you actually conduct some of the research? Like, do you do focus groups?
Oh yeah, we're really hands on here. And that's pretty, I'm learning that's kind of unique in the consumer insights world.
Exactly. That's why I was asking.
Well, good question. Yeah. This was, and of course I think this is it's sort of been a strength of mine that's going to wane over the years, but ethnographers will know that there's a big value in coming in like super naive and just being able to say, gosh, I don't know anything. Can you explain to me how this works, including all the underlying assumptions that aren't usually articulated, so that I can kind of get a lead on what's going on here. And one thing that I've learned in kind of more exposure to the consumer insights industry more broadly is that a lot of the times, it's somewhat unusual for an organization to have internally such a robust and well-developed research team. It's usually something, there's lots of great consulting firms or research groups that work externally as kind of in a different sort of relationship, and they do awesome work. But yeah, we're a little bit unique in that respect. So we have, as I mentioned, both our quantitative team who sort of designs and analyzes and reports on a lot of our survey work, and then the qualitative team who, I'm doing interviews with guests, I'm doing focus groups, I'm going out, walking around the parks, doing structured observations, I'm looking at the academic literature, I'm doing digital ethnography. It's pretty hands-on, which is another reason why I love this role, is that I get to do the research that, and I'm lucky too. I mean, we talked about sort of the topical and thematic alignment that you don't often get in a lot of corporate jobs. But my academic research was on media and pop culture fandom. And so there's a lot of resonances that I still get to play in those spaces. And it's not exactly the same thing. Like, there's definitely different, you know, different reasons and different motivations for the interest that Universal has for this work than I might have as a scholar. But it just touches on a lot of the stuff that I think is really exciting and cool. So yeah, that's fun.
Totally. Your interest in media and pop culture, I mean, it overlaps hugely with what Universal is trying to do. And as you were talking, I was just thinking about the importance of the research that you do for what Universal does, right? So, like, in my job, I've worked with a lot of those third-party research companies that do qual and quant stuff for product-based companies like, you know, Procter & Gamble and Adobe and places like that. So I've been in lots of focus groups where it's very product-oriented, but what Universal offers is experience-oriented, and that's a totally different thing. You know, it's still something that a consumer is paying for, but the way it's packaged and the way that you have to understand people's responses to it is not, do I see it on a shelf and buy it? It's, what is the experience of going, and how does that line up with the expectations that people have based on their love of whatever the, you know, the IP, well, to use the phrase.
Yeah, that's a technical term.
what do they think? Like, you know, if they're real Harry Potter fans, is that what they're going to get out of this? How does it line up with what they were thinking that this thing was going to be?
Completely. Yeah. I'm glad you brought that up, because this is, as I've started to learn more about the consumer insights world, there's a lot of stuff I've learned from folks that work in some of those third party vendor organizations that do the research themselves. But so much of what they're working on is product focused, as you put it. And I think from a research point of view, it's a great sell for ethnography, right? Because the use of ethnography is being able to kind of jump in the deep end of a complex social situation and keep yourself afloat there long enough to really see these complex processes at work and really break them down to their nuts and bolts. We can't sort of put a product on a table in the room of a focus group and say, not that anybody would do this is a bit silly, but say, what do you think about this product? Right. We have to kind of think both more abstractly, in the sense that we're asking people to talk about experiential things that aren't tied to one particular product. But also ask them to think in a more grounded fashion. We sometimes pull people into these focus groups from the park, and we'll, you know, we're talking about your day right now. Like, what are you feeling? What are you noticing?
Oh, so cool.
Yeah, those are fun ones. They're fun for us because we get to hear a lot of great stuff, and fun for the guests because often that means they get to take a break and sit in an air-conditioned room, which is a plus in Florida.
Yeah, and get a soda. it also makes me think, and I have been thinking this since I started interacting with the companies that do focus groups, that this kind of research is like the pairing for linguists and anthropologists as well, but specifically for linguists, because so much of the research that you're doing is dependent on the language that you are using and your sensitivity to the language that your research subjects are using, right? Like, just the use of one word over another word is the key to unlocking whatever that insight happens to be. And it's both how you conduct the research, like being really careful in the words that you're choosing, but also interpreting what people are saying to get at what's behind it. And that's what you need. You know, like, you need a linguist for that, really.
100%. Right? Yeah, I couldn't agree more. And it's been, you know, it's interesting kind of learning. It has been interesting the last couple of years learning how learning about the research output in this type of role. Because obviously you're not writing a 300-page dissertation, which, you know, thank God, I don't know if I really wanted to do that again. But in looking at some of the work we put out, it really started to dawn on me that a lot of what we're doing here on some level, and this is not, it's not all the work, but a lot of the qual work we're doing is on some level kind of a light form of what we might call discourse analysis or rhetorical analysis, because we're looking at, or perhaps frame analysis, right? Mm-hmm. We're getting them to talk about these concepts, and the insights we're generating are based on how a guest is talking about or talking around or speaking indirectly about these different topics. And so that's been really exciting for me in this role too. I didn't necessarily realize that's what it was going to be, but when I when I look at some of the products of research that we've shared in the organization, it's sort of been like, wait a minute. Yeah. Well, good thing you hired me. I do know how to do that because you're all doing discourse analysis and that's exciting.
Yeah, exactly right. I am all for linguists getting jobs in market research because I think, like I said, it's a perfect fit and you will unlock those insights through language better than anybody else can do because it's subtle, right? Sometimes it's super subtle and sometimes, you know, it's not even in the vocabulary that they're using, but maybe it's the structure of what they're saying and the order in which they're listing things that are important to them. Like you can really get into people's thought processes just by looking at the discourse, right? That's the discourse analysis part of it.
Couldn't agree more. You're right on the money.
Oh, that's so cool. Oh, what a great job you have. I'm so interested in this. So do you ever do internally focused research as well for like, I don't know, employee satisfaction or improving processes and things like that?
Some of the work we do overlaps with that. I think by and large, that's kind of the remit of HR and talent development in our organization. But you know, there is some work like there is some work that just has unavoidable overlaps. You know, if you think about people that come into a theme park, like the first thing they do is interact with a team member, an employee, probably at the ticket gater, probably before that, you know, when they're talking to a parking attendant when they first come in. And so if we're trying to understand the guest experience with parking, let's say, understanding the team member perspective as, you know, the folks who are in those parking toll booths kind of being that first point of contact with the guest, those folks are, their kind of experiences are going to be directly connected to the guest experience. So, you know, yes, ultimately the main focus of our consumer insights group is the consumer, the guest, but any ethnographer will tell you that you can't really look at those groups in isolation because they're always touching and interacting with these other groups. And often those other groups are our team members and employees. So, you know, there's definitely some areas of overlap, but I wouldn't say it's our main focus.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Interesting. Cool. Are there any other linguists on your team or are you the only one?
No, we do have another linguist. Yeah. He's working. I don't know how much he wants me to shout him out, but, it's great to have, he has a totally different background and focus than I do. Cool. He's on the quantitative team. And so, although sometimes I loop him into my little kind of pontifications and daydreams when I get a request from a client for research. And it's been a fun, you know, it's been a fun addition. And I think also fun educationally for the consumer insights team, because really the only linguist they've known up until now is me. And I have a really particular training and background. I mean, sociolinguistics and linguistic anthropology is one corner of that universe. Our other linguist has a totally different training, a lot more experimental work on sign languages. So that's just, it's just great to have someone else here to highlight what a diverse kind of discipline and area of study linguistics is. So shout out to him, although I'll be cagey about his name because I don't know how, I don't know how famous he wants to be.
That's totally cool. Oh, that's so interesting. Yeah, I like that point a lot. It really highlights something that sometimes people think about linguists in industry. It's like, you know, we're hiring a linguist and then they think you know everything about all linguistics.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, it's like, no, it doesn't work like that. It's like that question, right? Like, how many languages do you speak?
Yeah.
It's like, well, no, not every linguist is a polyglot. And I'm quick to tell people, like, I speak English really well. That's my language.
That's my specialty. Well, and also just the fact that by virtue of many people's training as a linguist, I can break down a lot of stuff in many different languages, but you better not ask me to speak to a guest in Italian. Don't ask me for that. I'll make do with what I can in Spanish and we'll find a way around. But, you want me to take a look at a survey response in Italian? I can probably muddle through that just as well as Google Translate. And so there's also these opportunities to educate stuff like what does fluency mean and how do we really assess that objectively? And that's always fun for people too, especially in a place like a theme park where we have like tons of international guests from all over the world. So we are getting research data from our guests from a ton of different venues in lots of different languages. And, you know, it's often, I think a lot of linguists don't like this, but I think for the work that we're doing, it's often fine to just throw that survey response in Google Translate, because we're just trying to get to, you know, a general sense of what was expected there, or what was expressed there. But, you know, having the training I do, it's nice to have that extra level of something about this, you know, automatic or machine translation seems weird. Like, does that seem to be like, is there something off here, or is this on track? Should I trust it? So, so the training is useful in that regard too. Even if you're not, I would never be so foolish as to call myself fluent in Italian, but, but I think I could manage with a survey response or two, you know?
Yeah, for sure. So one thing that I've talked with a lot of folks about is the idea of like what your output is, right? So you're running these surveys and you're gathering information, doing things. And then what you need to produce typically is some kind of report or, as you said, a recommendation. And the recommendation can be strong or it can be weaker. Or you can basically say, we have no idea because the data didn't give us a clear answer. But what the output is actionable, right? Like it's, this is the direction we need to go in, which feels very different from an academic type exploration where you're not trying to come to a decision at the end of it. So in that context, do you feel like the work that you've been doing has resulted in actual changes to the way things are done or the way programs are run at Universal?
Yeah, sometimes. And there's bigger and smaller impacts, certainly. I think the some of the work that my manager did that allowed, the reason that work launched a kind of organizational buy-in to develop a qualitative research team was because it led to really immediate solves. Like, we can do this directly. And so, you know, but it's all, there's so many confounding factors all the time. So it's hard to say that in advance. I will say that there are some projects we do, and it's often the projects that come directly, you know, that are requested of us. Like some internal partner wants to know more about X or Y. And because there's such a focused kind of directive there, we can just deal with that problem and find out based on this work, it seems like X is a good idea, or based on this work, it seems like you better go with Y because X will make too many people angry. But we also get to do work that is more conceptual and cultural in nature, in the sense that we're exploring these broad themes, like my research on fandom, which is totally related to Universal's interest. We don't always necessarily have a clear cut research question in the sense of, you know, find out how X fandom affects Y in park experience. We just want to know what that means as a cultural phenomenon. And then from there, strategize about, you know, how we might make use of that as a business. Mm-hmm. And that's the kind of space where we are going in with almost a bit more of an academic orientation, where we're not coming out and saying you should do X or you should do Y. But rather saying, here's the research we've done that highlights the broader cultural context of these phenomena, and certainly how people are talking about that. Here's some discourse analysis, the rhetoric around it, how these ideas are being framed in the broader culture, to make sure that any more specific decisions that are made around those topics are kind of grounded and motivated by reality, rather than, I don't know, You heard something offhand on the news, or you heard your kid talk about something, right? So it really depends on the scope and the type of the project, where those recommendations come from. But I'll say too, that's still a learning curve I'm working on. I definitely still have the academic instinct to just say, here's what I found, and maybe here's how it connects to some, you know, I hesitate to say theoretical framework, but we do, you know, whether or not we're calling them that in the corporate space, we do have these beliefs and these kind of ways of thinking that we're trying to test and poke holes on and revise as necessary. The instinct to offer a recommended business move based on that is still, that one's tricky for me. I'm still learning that.
Yeah, it's hard, but that's what they want, right? I mean, that's... The output is, please tell me what to do. And sometimes it's easy and sometimes it's extremely difficult. I have been there myself. It's funny what you said about, I really like this idea of providing the context, especially for pop culture and media and properties that are already out there. It's in my work when I'm doing naming stuff, our clients sometimes will go and like search things on Urban Dictionary. And I have to say, like, don't do that. Please don't do that. It is not a reliable research source. Let us do some real research for you. We can do it properly. Do not
totally.
Look things up on Urban Dictionary.
Yeah. Or, you know, if you're going to look it up in Urban Dictionary, let's talk about what Urban Dictionary is and what it means
exactly.
for something to come from there, right? It's not, you know, it might be a useful data point, but it's definitely not the whole story.
Right.
Makes sense. Yeah.
Yeah, totally. That's great. And I like too the level of engagement with microcultures. I don't even know what to call it, but you know, for the properties that you're talking about that Universal is working with and will continue to work with in the future, there are lots of places where fans gather, and those fan gatherings are different depending on where they are. Like the folks on Tumblr are really different from the folks on Facebook, right?
Oh, big time. Yeah. You know your stuff. Absolutely.
Well, I'm a big fan of many things. And you have to know what the context is. Who are you talking to? Like, what's the demographic? And who do you want to appeal to? And also, how do you deal with stuff that seems like, you know, big deals within that microculture, but which is actually not very important in the bigger thing. So I'm just saying that by way of saying to younger linguists, if you are really interested in these things, you can use that in your job. Like your fandom cred is great. It will help you. You can get a job and use it, and your knowledge will be really valued among the people that you're working for. You know, I think Gretchen McCullough's book, the Because Internet book, was just so influential in taking the lingo that you find online, which is so much of our discourse around media properties, and elevating it and saying, hey, it's real. Like, we need to look at this.
Absolutely.
You can't just ignore it and go, oh, it's just the internet. No, the internet is everything for certain groups of people. That's how they connect. That's how they talk about these things. And that's where your customer base is coming from. So you got to pay attention to it.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. And this, I mean, it's a difference I feel compared to being in academia working on this kind of stuff. And I mean, and I don't want to exaggerate, the vast majority of scholars that I worked with when I was kind of actively in the academic spaces were really interested and excited about the work I was doing in these topics. But mm-hmm. I mean, unfortunately, the kind of old guard still exists. And I do remember, you know, one or two not very nice remarks from, you know, some of my early work on Lady Gaga's online fan communities and the sort of discourse and language use there. So I remember one really not nice comment saying, but this isn't really real. This is just people talking online.
Right.
And it's
exactly.
Well, what do you mean? You have a phone in your pocket with the Twitter app on it right now. How is that not real? And here, you know, I think even though there's a lot of work to do to really understand those spaces from a consumer insights lens, there's like people are bought into the idea that important stuff is happening there and we need to find some way to understand it and pay attention to it. So that's been, you know, again, not to exaggerate how often I got those sort of snotty comments in academia, because they were quite rare, but nobody here is saying that to me. Everyone's saying, great. Thank God we have an expert who can get into those spaces authentically and really understand them kind of from an emic or an internal point of view. So that's been pretty refreshing.
Yeah, that's so awesome. I'm just glad we're getting to talk about this. I will say in a shameless bit of self-promotion, I wrote a paper in 1992 about slang that I had collected at Berkeley and about women's place in this slang thing. And at the time, I remember very few faculty were saying to me, what a great piece of work. They're like, it's just slang. It's just fluff. It doesn't mean anything. And out of all the stuff I've ever written, that has gotten the most citations.
No
even
surprise
now,
there. Yep.
In the
no
year of our
there.
Lord, 2024, people are still citing a paper I wrote in 1992, which blows me away. So
wow, that's amazing.
Incredible. So that kind of stuff is just so important. And I see a lot more linguists who are really promoting that and putting that forward. So it's not just I do this on the side. This is my work. It's important. Yep. And we need to recognize it. So so cool. Very exciting. Sorry, I'm just getting really revved up about this.
I love it. Yeah, thank you. I mean, I'm excited about it too. This is, I feel that I got really lucky in a pretty unusual way in terms of how this non-academic job that I sort of rolled the dice on and took a leap for, even though it certainly wasn't what I was planning, was not what I envisioned for my career. But I got really lucky with the way that it aligns with both my research skills and those mm-hmm. skills that are transferable that we were talking about, but also just my research interests, but also my own personal interests. I mean, I studied pop culture fandom because I'm in those spaces too, like sure. as a user, as a consumer. So it is pretty special to be able, I do often have those sort of pinch me moments where I'm like, wow, you guys are paying me money to work on this? This is amazing.
Oh, that's great. I want to pop back for a minute to the question that you were asked in your interview. And if you don't mind talking a little bit about your life now. So were you ready to make that leap into industry? And like you moved to Florida and your partner and all that stuff, like how did that affect you? How did that work out?
Still processing, Laurel. It was a weird moment because this was also a major learning curve for me. The hiring process for this job went so fast, or like light years faster than any academic job I was sure. used to, you know, applying for and sometimes getting interviewed for. So it did kind of, there was a sense of urgency that it's like, you know, somebody drops this change your life completely button on the table. And they're mm-hmm. like, you have to press it within the next week. Otherwise right. the button comes off the table.
Yeah.
And my kind of thought process in that moment, in the few weeks of interviewing that I went through, and then I had an offer in my hands, was thinking, okay, I have this vague non-plan for the future that I'll stay on my academic contract for another year. And then if no job I like, you know, kind of appears, I don't have any success with that, then I'll move back to New York and do some kind of boot camp. I mean, that's pretty mm-hmm. vague. And here I have in my hand something concrete. I don't know if I like it. I don't know if I'll like it, but I do know that it's this company that I think is pretty cool. There's all this overlap with my research interests and skills in that pretty unusual way. And I think the most important thing is that all the interviews and conversations that I had with other people on the Consumer Insights team were all really awesome people. I mean, it was these smart people, multiple anthropology PhDs, people who I felt really could understand me and get where I was coming from. Mm-hmm. And not only get it, not only understand it in an abstract sense, they were excited for the background I was bringing to the table. It wasn't just like, oh, she has no corporate experience, but I guess it's nice she has a PhD. They were saying, yes, you have the background mm-hmm. we want. Mm-hmm. We want someone just mm-hmm. like you. That kind of validation is not, I mean, it's not usual in any space, really. Yeah. So it was these confluence of factors that, you know, it was a really unique opportunity that I didn't expect I was going to see again or not anytime soon. There was this topical alignment with my research and personal interests. And then all the people on the team that I was talking to really just made me feel like I was going to be really valued there. And whatever this role ended up being, that my contributions and the expertise I was bringing to the table would be thrilling and exciting for mm-hmm. them also. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, it's all those calculations. That's when I made the bet. I thought, let's roll the dice on this and let's try to do something totally different. And I did. And it was awesome. It was a great decision.
How's it living in Florida?
It's great. I've lost my ability to tolerate winter, which is a challenge when I'm visiting family in New York. But I think I will credit this to my anthropological training. And I think any linguist who has, you know, experience doing field work in other parts of the world or even other parts of the country, I've developed not just a tolerance for it, but actually an interest for living in a lot of different places. I mean, at this mm-hmm. point in the U.S., I feel like I've bounced back and forth. You know, I was born in New York. I grew up in California. Then I lived in Argentina for a bit. Then I moved to New York again. Then I moved to Arizona and then North Carolina. Now I'm here. And I think that's awesome and special, mm-hmm. right? I get this experience. Anybody who lives in the U.S. knows that this idea of a monolithic American culture is foolish at best. And so mm-hmm. I've I've gotten to see lots of different kind of flavors and angles of that, which has been great. Orlando has been interesting because I definitely came in here thinking, well, it's like everything's oriented around the theme parks, right? Of course, that's not true. Of course, there's like so many more interesting things going on the ground here. There's like a really quite thriving and diverse like food and restaurant scene. So I can eat all kinds of stuff from all over the world. I'm a big fan of eating delicious food. So that's appealing to me. But there's always something different to discover, right, in these different places. Yeah. So, you know, my loss of a cold weather tolerance aside, which might be a plus. It's a plus in January when I see everybody's snowy pictures from New York and I'm sitting on my balcony, you know, having my little cup of tea in the sunshine. Then you feel great about living in Florida. But yeah, I mean, it's a new, not really new anymore. It's a place that I'm learning more about, and it's exciting to be here. And I appreciate that my training in these methodologies that make you not necessarily comfortable, but able to handle just jumping into the deep end in a new place and making sense of it and making it make sense for you. I think, I don't know, maybe I'm being foolhardy here, but I think I could live anywhere and be happy because I could find something cool about wherever I ended up.
I've heard that from other linguists as well. So do you have a relationship with the, not you personally, but your, what you do with the Universal in California?
Oh yeah, definitely. Our consumer insights team is scopes over both the Florida parks and the California parks. And we do even sometimes partner in a research sense with, we have parks in Japan and in China and in Singapore. We're not quite as closely connected to them, but the Hollywood park is right up there with us. We're working with them all the time.
Do you think, just speculating, in your job, you might get rotated to California or rise to a position where you're overseeing more multiple parks rather than just the Orlando park?
Yeah, I think it really depends on what the organization decides they want to do as the qualitative research program grows and kind of where we can be most impactful. I will say, you know, to do our work, we go out there, sometimes me, more frequently my boss and her boss, but we're out there doing kind of on the ground ethnographic work in addition to the quantitative work and the survey work that we do that's largely digital. But so, you know, we've got our presence there. And I think there's the way the company is going right now, there's a lot of value in kind of keeping those two teams closely aligned, kind of we're the same team, essentially. We're just bi-coastal. But who knows? I mean, there's we're opening a new park in Orlando next year, Epic Universe, which we're all really excited about. And so I think however that goes, however that changes the business, which sort of remains to be seen, will tell us more about how that partnership kind of looks and changes over the years. So that's anyone's guess.
Yeah. It just seems from the way you described it, that there's definitely, there will be more opportunities in your future or for the other people on your team. Like, it's not just, I am in Orlando and I'm going to work here forever. Things are growing, things are changing. There could be more and better opportunities in the future.
Absolutely. Yeah. I think you're definitely right about that.
Cool. Wow, this has been so great. Thank you so much for getting so into the weeds on this. I really love hearing about all of it. And the more you say, the more it just seems like it is a perfect fit for linguists, anthropologists, and of course, combining the two for the kind of work that you do. And so important to the work that Universal is doing at these parks, right? Like, this is the way to serve your customers. Just get out there and talk to them, right? Find out what they want.
Absolutely. Yeah. That's really the big message of a lot of this social science work in the corporate space, is reminding people that your consumers are not some weird, you know, alien mystery, right? They're human beings, and you can just go talk to them. And, you know, sometimes just go talk to them is not quite the methodology we need to answer a certain question, but you can learn a lot doing that. And if there's any group of people that is capacitated to just go out and talk to people, I mean, it's linguists. So there is a space and a need for them in this universe. Absolutely.
Oh, that's so cool. How wonderful. If it is okay with you, I will put your LinkedIn link in the show notes. Can people contact you if they want to just chat or do an informational interview or
Absolutely.
Ask questions?
Yeah, yeah. Anytime. I love talking to other linguists. I love kind of keeping connected to what's going on in that side of the world. So it's great for me. And yeah, hopefully an opportunity for other people to learn stuff. Feel free to reach out.
Oh, awesome. Mary Caitlin, thank you so much for talking with me. This was just delightful.
My pleasure. Yeah. Thank you for inviting me. It's been really fun.
Linguistics Career Launch is an ongoing nonprofit project currently led by volunteers that works to educate students, faculty, administrators, and industry employers about the value of linguists in business, government, nonprofit, and tech. The LCL has held two online boot camps during which attendees were able to learn from and interact with career linguists, as well as gain practical experience in career management skills. Videos of all our recorded sessions are available on our YouTube channel. You can get in touch at linguisticscareerlaunch@gmail.com.